This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we're not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Macro Voices episode 15 was recorded on May 19th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. CPM Group founder Jeff Christian will be joining me as today's feature interview guest. Many of you know Jeff as a precious metals expert, but his background is actually much broader than metals, so I'm looking forward to bringing you a side of Jeff that you may not have seen in his other media appearances.
And I'm Nathan Egger. Before we even get into the equities today, we're going to touch on monetary policy real quick. The minutes from the April 26th, 27th FOMC meeting were released on Wednesday afternoon, and everything from equities to treasuries to crude oil to gold instantly took a nosedive on that news. What happened, Eric? What's going on?
Abject silliness, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it reminds me of parents. I'm not a parent myself, but I see parents of 2 to 4 year olds planning, okay, we'll give little Johnny his birthday present, and then when Susie has a conniption fit and cries and throws a temper tantrum, we'll get her birthday present from last month, and we'll remind her she got something too, and then when little Jimmy gets upset, we'll bring out the birthday cake, and then we'll play pin in the tail on the donkey until both kids are so tired that they fall asleep and forget all about it by tomorrow. And I think the FOMC kind of works the same way. We've got exactly the same message that they've been telling us for years, which is it's data dependent. They are intending to be in a rate normalization cycle, meaning a hiking cycle, and they're going to see what the economy permits. The message has not changed. And frankly, the FOMC minutes, which were released on Wednesday, didn't change anything. What was covered in, I don't think anybody reads the entire statement except for maybe 10 guys. Everybody else goes by the short little one-line headline summary that Bloomberg and other news services put out. And they picked up on the fact that several members of the FOMC favored a June rate hike if the economy warranted, the exact same message that they've been telling us. Now, for people who bothered to read the next paragraph, it said that other members were very concerned about the global economy and didn't know if it could tolerate that. So there's no change here whatsoever. But what was highlighted for some reason was that the rate hike was on the table. A lot of people were assuming that it was off the table, even though that's really not consistent with what the Fed has been telling us. So they're posturing in order to allow any outcome. They're making it clear that the June meeting is a live meeting, that there could be a rate hike. And just like the parents who have to deal with the temper tantrums after the fact, what they did is they planned. They knew that this was going to have some effect on the market. So they had both Lacker and Dudley, two Fed governors, giving public speeches this morning. And I was actually surprised because the market had reacted so strongly negatively. What Dudley in particular said is, I don't know why people weren't listening before, because we've been pretty darn clear that the June meeting is a live meeting and that if the economy permits that we will hike rates. This is not new news, guys. It's stuff we've been talking about. A lot of big names. Jeff Gundlach was in the news today saying that he thinks something has changed at the Fed. I don't know what he thinks has changed. To me, they've been really, really consistent. There was a time that I can remember when we actually used to make decisions about investments based on economic fundamentals. And that would mean that a rate hike would be considered good for stocks because it indicated that the economy was turning up. What's amazing to me is that there's almost no discussion publicly in the media anywhere of the fact that monetary policy has totally distorted the price signal. What we now see is markets go up on bad news because people assume that there will be more accommodation from the Fed. Markets go down on good news. Good is the new bad. We've completely turned everything upside down and it doesn't make sense, but nobody seems to care.
So last week you said you were waiting for a daily close on the S&P below the 50-day moving average before you'd consider putting a short trade on yourself. And we got that close Friday last week. Did you go short? And how's that trade looking?
No, I didn't. Perhaps I should have. But what happened, I looked at that close Friday. I said, okay, I'm going to watch this on the open Monday. I did not want to trade it on the futures open Sunday because there was a pretty big spike down that looked to me like it was likely to retrace, which it did. So I looked at where I thought the technicals kind of showed resistance, and I came up with 2053 or so on the E-mini S&P futures contract. I thought that was a good sell point. Frankly, by the time we got there, the market was moving so quickly on oil-related hysteria to the upside, I knew it was going to go through that level, and so I decided to hold off and wait and see. Sure enough, what happened was we bounced notably back up above the 50-day moving average. So despite that daily close below it, it turned out to be a false breakdown, at least initially. There was some more strength. The day traders on Twitter, who are much better technical analysts, at least in the short run, than I am, were saying could be as high as 2090 before this euphoria is over and we see a move back to the downside. Of course, when we had this message come out of the FOMC, there was just a panic reaction to the downside. Even took out briefly this morning as I was interviewing Jeff Christian, we took out the neckline on a head and shoulders pattern that's been building since April in the S&P 500 futures contract. Sure enough, though, I watched that. I thought about trading it, and I said, you know what? This is Fed-driven nonsense. This is a panic reaction that doesn't make sense. And sure enough, over the course of the day, that has retraced. And although we're speaking still during the active trading day, I expect the close to be above that. I'm drawing the neckline right at about 2031. And I expect that we'll see a close above that today. So I don't know where this market is going. I definitely think that the fundamentals call for it to have been much lower, much sooner. But, you know, I was saying that as we were 100 points lower, still headed up. At 1950, I thought this thing ought to be done and ready to roll over. It went all the way to 2100. So I'm waiting and seeing. I definitely think the fundamentals are very bearish. But so, and I also think that the rate hike in June is very possible and not at all inconsistent with either this week or previous messaging from the Fed. It seems like we're back into euphoria mode this afternoon. And so I'm kind of taking a wait-and-see approach to this.
And of course, Eric, Crude Oil Voices is up next. What do we got?
Well, we promised last week, look, we're not going to let macro voices turn into crude oil voices. We just had so much news flow, we had to cover it. Well, this week we've got even more news flow, so I'll try to be concise. But when the facts change, I am forced to change my opinion, and the facts are changing really fast. Biggest news to come out since our last show, EIA, massive revisions to their surplus estimates. You'll remember, regular listeners on this program, when EIA came out and said the global oversupply had now reached 2.24 million barrels. I said, even as bearish as I am, that's hard to believe. I think the real number is less than that. They revised all those numbers and said, yeah, actually, we didn't mean it. It's much, much lower. That was a pretty big shot to the chest for the bears. But Sunday, Goldman Sachs, who previously has been even more bearish than I have, turned semi-bullish and said, look, we didn't expect this, happened way sooner than expected, but what's going on is this market just balanced itself much sooner than anybody thought, and sure enough, the tape action Monday, which was very brisk to the upside, was probably in reaction to those two things, Goldman Sachs and EIA. Meanwhile, we had been told last week, Fort McMurray situation pretty much under control, be working on getting people back into their homes, at least the homes that were survived the horrible, horrible destruction that occurred there, and everything's going to be fine. Oil production should be fully back online within a week or two. This week, the news is that the oil-producing assets, which we were previously told were never at risk, are at risk, and the fires have gotten worse in some areas. The Syncrude has completely evacuated. There was a message today on Thursday that they have told their customers not to expect any oil shipments for the month of May. And at the same time, we have Nigeria, the situation there escalating rapidly. There was a message from militants saying they're just getting started and they intend to shut down the entire Nigerian oil production capability. Today we did see the shutdown of their shipping port, and I just got that news before we taped this segment. I don't know whether that was terrorism related or some other security risk, but the port has been shut down somehow. Situation in Venezuela is deteriorating rapidly. There is a force majeure order from President Maduro, basically bypassing the Congress and trying to seize dictator authority over the economy because it is about to descend into total chaos. Libya's situation, meanwhile, has taken more oil offline. Analysts estimate that all of these factors together, Canada fires, Nigeria militants, Venezuela societal collapse, Libyan security tension, that's 3.75 million barrels per day taken offline. Remember, the whole bearish thesis was that there was an oversupply of 1 to 1.5 million barrels per day. You subtract 3.75 from 1.5, all of a sudden, what was a surplus turns into a deficit. Now, we still are at record storage levels, but it looks like we've not only totally eliminated the surplus, but at least in the short term, we've turned it into a deficit. We thought the Canada situation was temporary. Now, it may not be so temporary. That makes a huge difference in the Cushing storage crisis, because remember, Cushing is so important because it is the settlement location for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract. Cushing storage is being driven by that Canadian oil coming out of Alberta. You shut that down, and now the risk of a storage crisis in Cushing is mitigated dramatically. So the confluence of all these factors coming together, what it says to me is that we will probably muddle through this environment that we're in without actually getting to a storage crisis that would cause the price crash that Art Berman and I expected. So, you know, it sucks to be wrong, but the only thing that sucks more than being wrong is not being able to admit when you're wrong. And this is a case that's really frustrating because if I look at these fundamentals, if I look at this week's data, we were expecting, because of this 3.75 million barrels globally being taken offline, a million barrels being taken offline in Canada, everybody was expecting drawdowns across the board. We saw a national 1.3 million barrel build increase in national inventory this week against expectations of a drawdown of 3 million barrels. We saw Cushing, Oklahoma, despite the Canada fires, still showed a build of 500,000 barrels against drawdown expectations. Says very clearly to me that if not for the Canada, Nigeria, Libya, Venezuela situation, exactly the storage crisis that we predicted would be happening. But, you know, you cannot account for the randomness of geopolitics, and that's just how the oil market is. What's amazing to me, Cushing now, after this build, is now at 96.42%. operating capacity. No, I didn't misspeak. 96.5%. There's only 3.5% left in terms of Cushing operating capacity, but the market is not panicking about it because they're focused on other things. Now, in fairness, I need to define operating capacity. The way to think about it, you go to the filling station with your car, you put the nozzle in your gas tank, you squeeze the handle. If you're in a state which still allows you to put the little lock on, you put the lock on and you stand there and you wait until it automatically shuts off. When it automatically shuts off, that tank is at its operating capacity. That's what it's designed to support. We all know, even though it's illegal in some states, you can probably squeeze another gallon into that tank if you just milk it carefully and squeeze that handle gently in order to let a little bit of gas flow in without overflowing. That's also true of the big tank farms in Cushing, Oklahoma. So even though we're at 96.42% of operating capacity, they can go above operating capacity by a little bit. How much? Frankly, nobody knows because we never tried it before. And who knows what kind of logistic situations come up. So a crisis is still possible. We've only got 3% of operating capacity left. But with the Canada fires now looking like they're worsening, and it sounds like a whole month that some operators have already told their customers, we're not going to be shipping any oil. Boy, it sounds like we're going to get through this one. The one place I would say there's an exception to that, watch for a surprise from Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I haven't figured this guy out yet. I don't know what his agenda is. Why did he fire the previous oil minister, Al-Naimi? Is it because he thinks that Al-Naimi never should have let the price get this high, which Saudi Arabia didn't need to do? Or does he think that the whole idea of suppressing price in order to compete with other countries was a dumb idea and he wants higher prices? I don't know, but I'm waiting for a surprise from him. His last statements before the Doha meeting were certainly threatening. We can turn up production if we want to. I wonder if he's waiting for an opportunity to do that, but I really don't know what's on this guy's mind. Bottom line, we are now, despite the fact that I now think we can get through this without a storage crisis, we're still overbought on the RSI, right on the channel resistance line. Now, the reaction to the Fed was just amazing. 96.42% of operating capacity. That data came out that we are almost out of space at Cushing. Price went straight down, and then it retraced in less than 3 minutes. So the fact that we're out of storage space just isn't registering for traders. About an hour, well, a couple hours later, this meaningless statement from the FOMC minutes comes out, and everything crashes dramatically lower. So the market is responding to signals that I don't think important and is ignoring signals that I do think are important. One way or another now, before the FOMC-induced downspike, which as we're speaking looks like it's more than halfway retraced and will probably fully retrace, we're at channel resistance on the major trend. We're at an overbought signal on the RSI, relative strength indicator. These things all say to me, this is already built into the market. The price is already reflecting the fact the market thinks that everything is fine. We could still have a storage crisis. It's still possible. But even if it isn't, I think the market's already hit its high. A lot of fundamental analysts are saying that $50 is where everybody is going to continue hedging. And I've definitely seen strong signs of hedging this week. Watching the time spreads, they're collapsing exactly as I predicted. As we come close to $50 oil, what's happening is the price is going up on the front month, about 1 to 2 years out. The back months are being sold by hedgers who are protecting their ability to essentially lock in their prices and make themselves immune from another leg down. So definitely we're seeing that hedging as predicted. I did put on the curve steepener trade that I've talked about in previous shows, but no outright short here because my short conviction is not as strong now that I see that we can get through this without what I previously thought was an unavoidable storage crisis. Now, I'm saying we can get through it when we're at 97% of operating capacity. We're going to get to 100% of operating capacity. How much past 100% operating capacity is the real ultimate limit? I've scoured the internet. There's a lot of different opinions. I don't think anybody knows for sure. What's going to happen there is anyone's guess, but I am more interested in this point in looking away from directional trades and towards something like a term structure trade, a curve steepener in this case, which I think makes a lot more sense here.
Followers of today's guest, Jeff Christian's work, will know that he'll have plenty to say on gold, but what is the latest market action telling you, Eric?
Well, you know, gold really tanked hard and decisively took out its 50-day moving average on this FOMC minutes news, which I think was just a silly overreaction to nothing new. But one way or another, that's what it did. So what it says to me, as I have alluded in previous shows, is if the Fed follows through and hikes rates in June and continues in subsequent meetings to continue hiking rates, which is what they've told us very consistently their intention is, I think the party could be over for gold in the short term. Now, I definitely am very bullish gold in the long term. I think everybody has realized during the course of the day Thursday that Wednesday afternoon's overreaction was an overreaction. I'm looking at hammer patterns forming in the charts for crude oil, for gold, for S&P 500 futures. That says that basically this was a panic sell-off that didn't make sense and the market is coming to its senses. So I think gold will probably close today above its 50-day moving average again. It's actually trading just barely above it as we're speaking mid-afternoon on Thursday. And will it bounce up dramatically from here? I don't know, but I think that we're only a couple of weeks away from knowing what the June outcome is going to be. I think that if there is a rate hike in June, that probably gold is going to take it in the teeth.
And the dollar bulls are already out starting to pat themselves on the back as we broke above 95. And we really put some distance between the current prices and that May 3rd low. How is the U.S. dollar looking to you, Eric, in the wake of the Fed minutes?
Well, the wake of the Fed minutes is the key phrase there. Let's first look at it in isolation without considering that very important point. And boy, the chart looks fantastic. Not only have we taken out that downsloping trend line, the next thing to look for a technical analyst would be a higher high than the previous one. We've got the higher high. The next thing to look for would be the higher low and then another higher high after that. The chart looks absolutely fantastic. It appears that the bottom is in and that it's all uphill from here and it's all great. But hang on. There is just silly, irrational exuberance that happened in reaction to the FOMC minutes. As I've said, I don't think they're as significant as the market took them to be. So I would look for maybe a little bit of a retracement of this bullish action in the dollar index, see it come back down a little bit. What we need to see is we've got the higher high. We need to make sure that we get the higher low and not a lower low. And then I think the signals are looking pretty darn strong for the dollar bull market rally to continue. But right now, in reaction to the Fed, and of course a rate hike would imply a stronger dollar, because we now have a marketplace that has rate hike expectations they didn't have before the Fed restated what they'd already said previously, I think we might see a pullback before the bull market in the dollar continues.
Well, thanks for helping us to make sense of this mess. Truly sounds like a mess, Eric. Now, this week's featured guest, as mentioned, is Jeff Christian. He's the founder of the CPM Group, and he's probably best known as a precious metals expert. But what I've been learning this week is Mr. Christian's background is actually considerably broader than that. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy Eric's interview with Mr. Christian, whether you take an interest in the precious metal space or not. That interview is coming up next as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is CPM Group's Jeffrey Christian. Many of you know Jeff as a precious metals expert, but Jeff, I'd like to start with the U.S. dollar because so many other things hinge on that. Something I've noticed interviewing a number of experts on this program is everybody has a different idea about what caused this massive rally in the U.S. dollar in 2014 and most of 2015. So let's start with your view on why the dollar appreciated so much during that period.
I think there are a couple factors, but it all comes down to relative strength of economies. You know, and the U.S. economy over the last 18 months has been extremely attractive to foreign investors, while many other economies have been far less attractive than they were in the period, say, 2010 to 2013 or 14. And if you look at the strength of the United States and the advantages going for it, it has a lot of really big long-term advantages to other countries that give it a more powerful economic output. In addition to that, on a cyclical basis, over the last couple of years, the United States has been doing much better than Europe and Japan. China has actually been doing very well, but people haven't been giving it the credit because they're looking at percentage changes in factors instead of actual levels. But a lot of other emerging markets, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, have stumbled. And what you've seen, you know, our interpretation of the strength in the dollar since 2014 has been that a lot of people have been buying dollars because they wanted to invest in the United States stock market, real estate, and corporations. So there's been a demand for dollars in order to take advantage of the relative strength of the U.S. economy. And I think that's the major factor that has been behind the strength of the dollar. There's another factor which I'll throw out, which is relative interest rates, and not so much for individuals but for commercial banks. You have the Fed in the United States paying banks 25 basis points for excess reserves, whereas you have negative interest rates on excess reserves in other countries, Switzerland, the EU bloc, now Japan. And that has been a major factor in the overall economy, but I think it's also been a factor in the strength in the dollar, in that you can just park your excess reserves here and earn 25 basis points as a commercial bank rather than take the risks of lending it out to people.
And what is your view going forward? Some people are saying that the top is in, the dollar index touched 100 and that's it, we're headed down from here. Others say this is just a pause and the dollar's headed much higher. What's your view?
My view is in the middle of those two. I think that we won't see the kind of strength that we've seen over the last 18 months in the U.S. dollar, that big shift has gone away. And in fact, staying on that topic for a second, what we think that we're seeing in the first several months of this year is that there's a rebalancing of global portfolios. And it's not that anybody is abandoning the United States economy, stock market, real estate market, and takeovers of the U.S. corporations, Bayer versus looking at Monsanto, for example. It's not that anybody's abandoning the U.S., but they're rebalancing their portfolio, and they're saying, okay, because Brazil and China and Japan and Europe and other countries have been hammered down, they now have some short-term or cyclical advantages and attractions that they didn't have 18 months ago. So what we're seeing, I think, in the dollar is a shift, a partial shift away from a mad dash into U.S. investments toward a more balanced global approach. But I think the emphasis will continue on U.S. investments because we still have these longer-term relative strengths. Now, that given my background, that's my background for it, and how I think that interprets itself into a trade-weighted dollar, is that we maybe not haven't not seen the top. I think the dollar will move sideways with an upward bias in a less volatile fashion. So I don't see the dollar on a trade-weighted basis, and we look at the Fed trade-weighted dollar. You know, I don't see it going back to 80 or 75 or anything else. You know, I see it staying basically above 85 over the next couple years, but I also see it probably moving somewhat higher and taking out its early 2016 peaks over the next couple years as well. So I see it moving sideways with an upward bias in a less volatile fashion over the next couple years.
Now, just Wednesday of this week, FOMC minutes were released from the April meeting, and it appears that markets are having something of a temper tantrum in reaction to the Fed hinting that perhaps some members thought that a June rate hike was possible. In the short 5.5 minutes that we've been speaking mid-morning on Thursday, the S&P 500 futures have broken down below a fairly key neckline in a head and shoulders pattern that goes back to April. Gold is trading below its 50-day moving average for the first time in 3 weeks or so. Do you think there's significance to this announcement, or do you think that we're just having a short-term temper tantrum reaction to yesterday's news?
I think it's a short-term temper tantrum. You know, Fed board members, FOMC board members, can think whatever they want, as long as they don't act on their thoughts. And we've seen 18 months of them thinking but not acting, and then there was one action in the last 2 years. So I think the Fed can say, yeah, maybe we should raise interest rates. And you know, importantly, they said, if the economy looks significantly stronger, and I do think the economy will show signs of strength over the next 4 or 5 weeks before the next Fed meeting. But I think that the Fed should remain extremely hesitant about raising interest rates. It may not raise interest rates in June. And if it doesn't raise interest rates in June, that probably puts the kibosh on it until after the election. So I think that what you're seeing is the markets are reacting to these comments, but it's probably an overreaction. You know, if I were a short-term investor, I'd be more likely to be buying S&P calls than puts.
Okay. Let's go ahead and move on to gold now. As I mentioned, we are just today breaking below the 50-day moving average, although we haven't seen a close below it yet. What is your take? You know, with the dollar, you've kind of taken a neutral view. Do you think that gold is the bottom is in and the rally is on, or do you think this is temporary, the strength that we've seen in the last few months?
I think that what we've seen is, you know, I think gold made a cyclical low in December. And coming off of that cyclical low in January through March, you had a very rapid appreciation, which reflected several things. One was real investors, longer-term investors, and shorter-term investors coming back into the gold market to buy gold because the cyclical lows seem to have been made, but more importantly because they were worried about the stock market. Interest rates were moving down. The Bank of Japan moved to negative interest rates. There was concern about a U.S. recession. There was a concern about Chinese recessionary economic conditions. There were a lot of factors that were causing investors to buy gold. And coming off of that low after, you know, I think it was about 4.5 years of declining prices since September 2011, coming off of that low, what you saw was a massive amount of liquidation of short positions, not only on the COMEX where you have numbers, but also anecdotally in the forward market, and also an enormous increase in long positions. On the COMEX where you have numbers, you saw about 7 million ounces of short gold open interest liquidated by institutional investors in the first 4 months of this year. And that represented about two-thirds of the short position. So you've had this massive short covering, and then you also had about 15 million ounces of fresh long building. Now, maybe half of that 15 million ounces was the guys who were liquidating their 7 million ounces short then went long. But then you had additional investors who were not short going long. But, you know, coming off of the floor in December and early January, you had the price goosed by this shift away from shorts to long positions. I think that that's in the market and in the price now. Our expectation is the price probably cools off over the next 3 or 4 months. There's a lot of reasons for that economically, seasonally, fundamentally. But, you know, the question is, how low does it go? You know, does it go to 1180? Does it go to 1130? I think it doesn't go back to the December lows, that the cyclical decline is behind us. But I'm not necessarily looking for it to race sharply higher in the next 5 months or the next 10 months the way it has in the last 5 months.
You mentioned commitment of traders and positioning with respect to longs and shorts. I'm curious as to your view on the relevance of the commitment of traders reports for gold in specific, because I rely on them heavily in the oil market. But my feeling is they're relevant because NYMEX represents the entire WTI oil market. In the case of gold, COMEX futures are a very, very small percentage of the overall gold market. Most of it is the London Exchange. So it seems to me that what you're seeing in terms of commercial and speculative long and shorts in the commitment of traders reports is probably nothing more than arbitrage flows between LBMA and COMEX markets. Am I missing something there? Is there more relevance to COT with respect to gold than I think there is?
I think there is more relevance there because the COMEX is a significant place where a lot of short-term investors get involved. I will say this, we rarely look at the commercial positions because the commercials are really hedging their OTC positions and or they are providing the liquidity that the institutional investors want on the other side. So people talk about the large buildup in short positions on the COMEX. That usually reflects the fact that the commercial, the banks and brokerage houses are going long in the physical market, which is actually negative because that means that there were more buyers than sellers in the physical market. It also means that people are going long in the futures market because for everybody, every investor that comes in and says, I want a 100-ounce gold futures position on the long side, there has to be a commercial entity that sells it to them. And so the commercials are far less important. But we look at the institutional investors, and we look at them across commodities, not just gold. And I do think that you see some very important trends there. So, for example, in the first quarter of 2013, you saw a reemergence of institutional investors who were willing to go long and went long at historically large amounts after about a decade of being very reluctant, I mean, going short. Institutional investors in the first quarter of 2013 went short at historically large levels after a decade of being very reluctant to short gold futures. And that was a gigantic sell signal. You know, and that sell signal, which was really in place by the end of March, then was manifested in the mid-April, you know, April 12th, April 15th, decline in gold prices. But you saw this in the commitment of traders as well as in the OTC market in Shanghai. You saw this growing bearishness on the part of institutional investors, which was a giant sell signal. So I think it's a little bit more important than just an anecdote. But one of the things you always have to pay attention to, and one of the points we always tell our clients, is you have to understand the futures market is not the physical market, and the people who participate in the futures market are different entities than the people who are buying physical gold.
And what about silver? We're seeing more weakness today in silver than we are in gold. Is that just because it tends to be a more volatile product, or is it because it's an industrial as well as a precious metal?
I think it's partly because it's more volatile. I don't think it reflects its industrial nature. I think it's the smaller size. And also a lot of people are much more skittish about being long silver. Silver has had a better run-up than gold over the last 5 months, and there was some nervousness. And it got up to, you know, $18 and started to back off. And while there was a tremendous amount of bearishness as long as it was rising, as soon as it fell, you start seeing some people reevaluate their bullish positions. And then, you know, today I think one of the things that you saw was it broke below $17 in a very forceful way. And that led a lot of short-term people to get out of their positions.
Yeah, very forceful. We're speaking mid-morning on Thursday, and I'm looking at 16 spot 36. So we've lost quite a bit just this morning. I know that CPM Group has also done some research on the other precious metals, the ones that nobody talks about, which, of course, are palladium and platinum. What's going on there? What do you guys see happening?
That's an interesting one because, you know, platinum and palladium tend to be mined together. Platinum is dominantly mined in South Africa. It's probably about, you know, 73% of mine production comes from South Africa. The South African mining industry is in extremely bad shape and probably is facing a lot of long-term problems that we're not sure how they're going to be resolved because there are also political issues. So that, on the surface, sounds bullish. But if you dig down into the fabrication side, platinum tends to be used in diesel vehicle, auto catalytic converters that clean up the exhaust for diesel vehicles. And palladium tends to be used in catalytic converters for cleaning up gasoline or petrol-powered engines, internal combustion engines. And there's a massive shift going on away from diesel to petrol. And then within the diesel market, you also see some technological changes. So the first thing is people are moving away from diesel passenger cars. You've seen market share of diesel passenger cars in Europe. The two big markets for diesel passenger cars are Europe and India. India got rid of its diesel fuel subsidies in December 2014 and lost about 10 or 12% of its diesel market share last year. So you're already seeing a shift away from diesel toward petrol in the Indian passenger vehicle market. And then in Europe, they're starting to move away from it, and you've gone from about 56% of the passenger cars being diesel to about 51% last year, with a continuation of that and probably an acceleration of it in the years ahead. So in terms of the passenger car market, you're losing diesel market share. Diesel is still very important for trucks, lorries, and buses, and that's going to continue. So you're losing diesel to gas, and that means less platinum use in autocatalysts and more palladium use. But then within the diesel sector, you're seeing more palladium being used relative to the platinum than used to be the case, and you're seeing this thing called selective reduction catalysts, which use urea instead of precious metals, being used, especially with trucks and buses, and actually, you know, BMW, Audi, and Mercedes are using SCR technology on their high-end passenger cars. And now Volkswagen, in the wake of its scandal, said that they're probably going to go to SCR. So SCR uses a little bit of platinum, but mostly urea. So platinum is losing market share within the diesel market, and the diesel market is losing market share within the vehicle market. And that means less platinum demand and more palladium demand. Now, so that's, you know, bearish for platinum, bullish for palladium. And then you go back to what I was saying about mine production, which is primarily platinum in South Africa. It becomes a very bullish story for palladium and not so bullish for platinum.
Now, is this a trend that's early enough in its history that we would consider something like a pairs trade, long palladium and short platinum, or is this already played out and too late for that trade?
No, I think it hasn't played out. I think it's got a lot further to go. We know people who are doing pair trading, you know, shorting platinum, buying palladium. Most of our investors don't necessarily want to short platinum, but they are going long palladium at the expense of not going long platinum. So, yeah, it's a very interesting trend. It's a technological change, and A, it's early in the days, so you can still get into it, and B, the market itself hasn't necessarily focused on it.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first on Macro Voices. You gave a presentation a few weeks ago about commodity markets in general, and our registered listeners will receive that presentation before you receive the podcast in our Research Roundup email blast. So give us a sense. Basically, I think the gist of the presentation is the 3 to 5 year bear market in commodities. I'm not sure if you think it's over or it's late in its life, but it certainly is getting tired. Where are we in the commodity cycle? What are the factors that are going to determine when the bottom is in? And where do you see things headed from here?
Yeah. You know, our view has been, we started talking about a long-term secular upward shift in commodity prices around 2000, 2001. And our view was, you know, commodity super cycle is just marketing, but there are a lot of basic economic factors. You had all of these people uncaged economically around the world who were stepping up, and it wasn't just China. China was very important, but it was India and the former Soviet republics and Eastern Europe and Brazil and other parts of Latin America and Africa. And you saw a tremendous amount of growth. You know, real GDP on a global basis went from 3.2% per annum in the period 1980 to 2000 to 4.5% from 2000 to 2007 when the Great Recession hit. And so you had this upward shift in the fabrication demand and consumption demand curves for commodities. And you saw almost all commodities rise. Around 2006, 2010, we started saying, look, we may reach a cyclical peak within the secular bull market. And we could see commodity prices correct downward for 3 to 5 years. That cyclical peak occurred for most commodities around 2011, and we are now about 4.5 years into it. And it's looking to us as if we've probably made the lows for a lot of commodities. There are some commodities we don't like for fundamentals to those individual commodities. But, you know, for a lot of commodities, it looks like we've made a cyclical low. And it's not that we're just looking at the price. We look at the fundamentals of supply and demand. And we also go back to those commitment of traders. If you look at the commitment of traders reports, what you saw over the last couple of years as the dollar was rising, you saw this very strange and unexplained enormous increase in short positions from institutional investors across commodities. And what we think you saw were a lot of investors putting money into commodities which had been hammered down at a time when the stock market was rising and rising and rising but looking top-heavy. And there was increasing concern about the state of the global economy and the U.S. economy. If you go back to the first quarter of 2014, first quarter of 2015, and the first quarter of 2016, you will find the financial press kept talking about, is the U.S. in a recession this year? And each year, by the time you get into the second quarter, they say, no, it was just a cold winter. You know, so you had investors being concerned about the economic environment, concerned that the stock market was looking top-heavy, and there was some money moving into commodities. But the money was being manifested on the short side, and you had this unprecedented short side build up across commodities. Now, over the last 5 months, you've seen an enormous liquidation of that short position and a large increase in the long positions, which tells us that a lot of institutionally managed money has moved into commodities over the last couple of years. And again, you know, as I was explaining with gold, you get off that bounce where you have, once people's computers tell those people that the low was in, the computer is telling them, liquidate your shorts and go long. And I think that we've seen that across commodities. So I think that we're probably at the end or a little bit past the end of the bear market in commodities, the cyclical downward pause, and we're going to resume the secular bull market going long term, because a lot of the economic conditions that fuel that bull market remain in place.
And with your views on the dollar, you said you did not expect a screaming rise higher, but over time you did expect higher U.S. dollar. A lot of people have forecast that the higher U.S. dollar could eventually lead to an emerging market debt crisis. Would you agree with that view, or it sounds like maybe your dollar view is not quite high enough, fast enough to bring on that kind of outcome?
I think that our dollar view is not quite so dramatic as to do that. but I think that there are real risks of debt crises in the emerging markets, similar to what we saw in 1981 and 82 when we had the international debt crisis back then, but with several important differences. A, these economies are much larger and much more important on a global basis, and B, the tendency to cooperate among governments that we saw in 1981-82 has largely dissipated. So I think that handling a future emerging market debt crisis will be a lot more difficult because the political willpower and capacity to handle it is diminished over the last three decades.
And what about China in specific? I know you mentioned it referenced commodities, but in a broader context, just some people feel that the overall global macro backdrop, China is probably the biggest risk if their troubles continue. So would you agree with that view, and do you think that their troubles will continue?
I think China is an economy that has grown tremendously for the last 30 years, 35 years, and it's continuing to grow. It does have problems, but I think the problems are grossly overblown in the Western press and grossly misunderstood. So if you look at, for example, the dollar value or the yuan value of GDP growth in 2015, 2015 GDP grew about 6.9% according to official statistics, but the actual value increase in Chinese GDP at that 6.9% growth was roughly equivalent to the value increase in 2007 when GDP grew 14.7%. So part of it's simple. We don't teach math in universities or high schools or grade schools anymore in this country. So some of it's just bad math on the part. People say, China used to be growing 9 to 15% per annum, and now it's only growing 6.5%, 7% per annum. But part of that is the fact that the Chinese economy used to be a $3 trillion economy, and now it's a $12 trillion economy. You could see, I use the example a lot of times of high-speed railroads. Chinese policymakers have had the country building 1,000 kilometers of high-speed rail every year for about 17 years now. The first year it was immeasurable growth in high-speed rail. The second year it was a 50% growth. And now it's down to about a 5% growth rate, But it's still 1,000 miles or 1,000 kilometers of high-speed rail every year using the same volume of aluminum, same volume of concrete, same volume of steel, and same volume of copper, but people don't necessarily see that. Now, as I said, there are problems within the Chinese economy. They're trying to do something that's unprecedented in terms of the mass urbanization of farmer subsistence farmers. They have a lot of issues that they're dealing with, but I think that they have the capacity to deal with them, and they seem to be doing that so far.
Let's move next door to Japan. Kyle Bass, of course, has been very outspoken in saying Japan is in its end game, and the yen and JGBs are potentially imminently in big trouble here. What do you think about that view and Japan's role in the global macro backdrop in general?
Well, Japan has been diminished and is going to continue to diminish. It has demographics against it. It's got a lot of financial problems. It has not been able to grow sufficiently to really get itself out of the malaise that it got itself into in the 1990s. And the policies that they have in place weigh against them getting things better. They have to make some radical changes in the way they view themselves, view their place in the world, allow immigration, allow other people to come in and help build up the country, and deal with the social compact between the government and an aging population. And, the United States and European countries all face the same problems. Japan may be worse in many ways than a lot of European countries in terms of its reluctance to do the things it needs to do. And from a long-term perspective, the need to revise the social compact between governments and people in Europe, Japan, the United States, even in some of the emerging economies, is one of the biggest negatives we see to long-term growth and one of the biggest positives for investing in gold.
And speaking of positives for investing in gold, let's go around the globe to Europe. Boy, you know, between the sovereign debt situation and now the migrant crisis, seems like Europe is really having some difficulty. Where do you see that situation going from here?
It's very, I don't know. I mean, yeah, and, you know, the fact that I don't have a clear view of where Europe is going is meaningless, but the fact that a lot of people look at Europe and they say, I don't see how this thing gets resolved, is very important, and I think that that's where it is. I think the British referendum on EU membership on June 23rd is actually very important for the future of Europe. You know, one of the things I've been surprised by is the number of wealthy Tories that I know who have shifted from being lifelong pro-EU membership to saying, well, maybe it is time to leave. You know, the EU was created in the 50s and 60s, and then into the 70s and 80s, it was actually organized and all and built upon in an era of increasingly larger governments. But by the time you got into the late 80s, into the 90s, and going forward from there, the big social trend was devolution of political power into ever smaller regions. And so I think the EU and global governmental type structures are kind of passé, and they're running counter to what people want and what society wants. And what I'm finding in England are these people who, you know, lifelong supporters of membership to the EU saying, we probably should get out, and this should probably be a good time. And my comment was, I think the time will come when devolution of power in the EU makes sense, but I'm not sure this is the time. And their reaction is, well, maybe it is the time, and maybe if England says we want out, it starts the process elsewhere. And that's a very interesting thing. So I think that the British referendum on June 23rd actually has a lot more political and economic importance than just what happens in England. And then when you start looking at Europe, as you said, you know, you've got major problems. You have the social compact that's broken down. They have gotten better in terms of their management of sovereign debt in that the courts have ruled, and you saw this last year with the Greek rescheduling, the governments have greater capacity to deal with the problems of sovereign debt. But the sovereign debt problems are just going to grow and grow and grow until you have a redefinition of the social compact. And that is just not on the horizon there. And meanwhile, you have this immigration flow. I mean, if you look at the UN's demographic numbers, you know, Europe has been contracting in population for decades, and they have it turning around over the next several decades. And when you say, well, what's going to cause the population of Europe to grow, it's immigration. And if I can go back to Japan for a second, you know, one of the problems with Japan is their hesitance to allow immigrants to come into the countries. Then you go to Europe and you say, well, who's immigrating there? These are not people who are coming to Europe to live the European dream and make their fortune. These are political, religious, socioeconomic refugees and immigrants. And in many cases, what they try to do is get to Europe so they can get to England, so they can get to Canada, Australia, or the United States. You know, one of the most embarrassing things is the refugee camps in Cadiz at the entrance to the channel, because you have all these people who are willing to risk their lives walking through the channel tunnel or riding under trucks to get to England from France. So in Europe, you have an immigration problem, but these are refugees. They're not people coming to make the dream. And then in Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, other countries, you have people coming there because they want to work really hard, work 90 hours a week, and make a fortune and live a better life. And that difference in the types of immigrants that North America attracts compared to Europe and Japan speaks volumes about why the dollar probably won't collapse.
Now, Russia's economy is obviously under tremendous stress as a result of depressed oil prices. I saw a headline, I forget who the gentleman's name was, but a former European military commander was very outspoken in the press saying that he's appalled that European governments are not preparing for outright war with Russia because he thinks it's inevitable. I don't know about that view, but I certainly see tremendous pressure building on Russia's economy with the oil situation. So what do you see there in terms of both geopolitical risk and economic factors as a result of the Russian economic depression?
Well, I'm concerned about the military issues, but I'm probably more concerned about the social and political. And Russia has any number of problems, declining population, very unproductive industry, very unproductive labor force that they're not really dealing with. These problems were extremely difficult in the 1990s, and you had had measured real GDP falling 5 to 10% per year in the late 1990s. Putin came in as a reformer, and he was starting to make some reforms, but then he got off track. And the higher oil prices from 2000 to 2011, I think, sort of papered over a lot of these problems. Now, with the lower oil prices, the problems are very much apparent again, and there doesn't seem to be too much of a policy move to correct them. And so I think that Russia, from a political, economic, and social perspective, is facing really large problems with no signs that the government or society in general are acting to address those issues. Whether that is reflected in militarism or not is partly Russia's fault, and it's partly the U.S. and NATO's fault, too. The U.S. had promised them when they agreed to allow the Germans to reunify that the U.S. and NATO would not extend NATO beyond Germany. And we broke that promise. And when the Russians complained about it, the U.S. State Department said, well, we didn't put it in writing. That's not the way you work among countries that want to be friends with each other. I once had a CEO of a company that had done us wrong say, well, we've talked to our lawyers and we don't have any legal liability here. And I said, no, it's just an ethical liability. And he said, well, then we have nothing to talk about. And, that's not the way you do business if you want to do business on an ongoing basis. So I think that you've got a real problem with the Russian psyche, which is not only pervasive within the Kremlin, but it's pervasive with 60 or 70% of the Russian population, according to various polls. You have the Russian the Russian psyche looking at itself as set upon by the West, and you have the West sort of saying, let's set upon the Russians. So you have a lot of saber rattling on both sides. It's extremely problematic. It's extremely worrisome. And when you've got generals saying, we really should be preparing for war with them on both sides, it just makes it that much more dangerous. I don't know if a war will come, but, again, the political leadership in the United States, the political leadership in NATO, and the political leadership in Russia all seem to be unprepared to avoid war.
Russian scholar Sergei Glazyev has articulated a plan where he says that Russia should engage in economic war with the West before outright real war. And he suggested that the reason that the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency is because there is no viable alternative. And he therefore reasons that Russia and China should work together to create a viable alternative. Number one, do you think that there's any realistic chance of that happening? And number two, do you think that it is possible if these things were to happen, if Russia and China tried to create an alternate currency that was backed by gold or something, as some have suggested, would that actually change anything? Would it cause central banks to prefer that currency? Or is Mr. Glazyev just spitting into the wind to suggest these ideas?
I don't know Mr. Glazyev, but every country has people who come up with radical ideas. And I think it's a sign of democratic progress that in Russia and in China, you hear people say, well, we should have a gold standard and stuff like that, even though the government and the central bank don't buy into that and don't want that. they allow people to say those things. I think that there are two big issues that you have. The second one is the currency issue and the dollar and the future of international currency regimes. And the first one that I want to address is the idea of Russia engaging in economic warfare. The Soviet Union and post-Soviet Russia have always worked hard to disengage their economic and commercial activities from their political activities. The United States has always been, well, we go back and forth. We vacillate between saying there's a relationship between human rights and commercial practices, and we're going to meddle in other countries. If you look at the history of the Soviet Union and then the post-Soviet Russia, what you find is that these guys have worked very hard, even at the height of the Cold War, to be responsible suppliers of raw materials and other goods to the world. So, you know, in the platinum and palladium market, like last year when you started seeing the U.S. and Europe impose increased sanctions on Russian entities, there were people in the platinum and palladium market saying, well, Russia may stop exporting palladium to Europe and the United States because of these sanctions. And the Russian government said, no, we're not going to do that. That's not what we do. We disaggregate our commercial activity from our political activity. And yes, we don't like the sanctions, and we don't like the belligerence toward us, and we don't like what we see as a cultural refusal to understand why Russia does what it does. But that doesn't mean we're going to resort to economic warfare. Now, the Soviet Union did that, as I said, throughout its history, including at the height of the Cold War. And post-Soviet Russia has done that, too. So I think the idea that Russia changes its stripes and starts engaging in economic warfare is probably highly unlikely. It's possible, but I think it's highly unlikely because there's a cultural embeddedness, you know, that you don't do that. So I don't see that the Russians would engage in economic warfare. Also, the Russians are very straightforward. If they're going to attack you, they're going to attack you. You know, the U.S. will smile in your face, you know, and then stab you in the back. That's our history. That's not their history. Now, going on to the currency, most central banks around the world have spent the last 20, 25 years now talking about and thinking about what happens in a post-dollar international currency regime. And the problem is there's nothing on the horizon to replace the dollar. The dollar has hegemonic power within the monetary system. Something like 62% of monetary reserves held by central banks are held in the dollar or dollar-based assets. And something like 75 or 80% of private sector wealth is in dollars on a global basis. So for you to move away from the dollar to something else or a basket of currencies or something else, you'd have to have this massive increase in liquidity in those other currencies. And if it's a basket of all the other currencies combined, you have hyperinflationary pressures because of the monetary liquidity creation. So we as a world have been trapped into a world that is sort of locked into the dollar. Central banks look at it and they say, we would love to slowly and non-volatilely move toward a world where we have a multipolar international currency regime where there's enough liquidity in other currencies that they don't necessarily compete, but they complement the dollar. And it's going to take decades to do this if we can do it at all. And it's going to take a level of international cooperation that we really haven't seen since the 1970s or 80s, I guess, on a global basis. But this is what central bankers would like. They don't necessarily see any role for gold in denominating currencies. They do see an enhanced role for gold as a monetary reserve to help them diversify away from the dollar and as they diversify into other currencies as well. But I think the long-term goal that central bankers see is a situation there. Now, you know, there are two gigantic obstacles. One is the lack of liquidity in alternative currencies, including gold, to the dollar. And the other one is national laws prohibiting people to hold wealth in other currencies. So you need governments around the world to sort of say, okay, we wanted to liberalize our currency and banking system. Turkey did this in 2011 during the financial crisis in Europe and in the EU next door in Greece. Turkey said, okay, you can hold wealth in Turkish lira, dollars, euros, or gold in our banks. And those dollars, lira, and gold can be used to meet reserve requirements, freeing up the Turkish lira in the banks to be lent to keep Turkey out of the economic recession that Greece and the rest of Europe was falling into. But Turkey is a small country, and we've been surprised that other countries haven't pursued that similar policies. That's got to be done on a global basis, but it's got to be done unilaterally by each country. You know, the United States, European countries, South Africa, Brazil, China, Russia, all of these countries slowly but surely have to get to the point where they can say, our citizens can hold their wealth in whatever currency, including gold and silver, that they want. And that then allows you to start moving toward this post-dollar system. And I think, you know, if you talk to the central bank in Russia or China or Japan, or you talk to European central bankers or Latin American central bankers, this is what they would like to try to move toward. And they've been stymied, I think, by, as I said, the breakdown in international cooperation on a political and fiscal level. And they've been stymied by other problems, too. I don't necessarily see a new currency created by China and Russia, with or without a gold backing, ever being a viable alternative to the dollar.
Finally, before we close, I want to go back around the globe to New York City and talk about what you guys do at CPM Group, because I think, honestly, you're one of the most misunderstood people. You've spent a lot of energy, Jeff, debunking some of the conspiracy theories in the gold and silver markets, and that's kind of made you the target of the gold bugs as public enemy number one. My favorite allegation is that Jeffrey Christian is nothing but an apologist for the bullion banks, who turn out to be your direct competitors, as I understand it. So tell us what you actually do for a living at CPM Group.
Right. CPM Group is an independent commodities research consulting company. We do a lot of very basic research. We develop good numbers on supply and demand for precious metals, specialty metals like vanadium, molybdenum, and manganese that don't have good stuff. And we also do a lot of research on energy, agricultural, and other commodities. So we study the commodities markets, and we apply economic and econometric practices to analyzing these markets that a lot of other people don't do. In addition to that, because we're in New York and because we grew out of the financial system, we were originally the research department at J. Aaron, then we became the commodities research group at Goldman Sachs. And 30 years ago this month, by the way, I was running the commodities research group at Goldman Sachs, and 30 years ago this month, I bought it from Goldman and set up CPM Group as an independent shop, saying, I don't want to be involved in an investment bank. I think there are inherent conflicts of research being owned by investment banking and trading companies. I want to set up an independent shop and provide research, consulting, and financial consulting to people. So our five product lines are research and commodities-oriented consulting, but then we also do a lot of work on financial consulting, on hedging and materials management across commodities. We also do work on asset management, and we'll advise companies and investors on managing their assets, whether they should be buying gold. Right now, we're spending a lot of time telling people don't buy lithium mining companies because we don't think lithium makes sense. We'll do commodities management, asset management, and then we do some financial advisory work and investment banking advisory work, where we'll help we'll help a company do a gold prepaid forward to finance development or expansion of a mine. We'll analyze mining opportunities for institutional investors and say, you know, okay, you've been approached by this guy who wants to develop a lithium mine. Don't buy it. Or, you know, we'll look at individual assets that people are interested in buying, and we'll help them determine determine whether or not it makes sense for them to invest in them.
And you were kind enough to send us a couple of sample research notes that sort of give our listeners a sense of what you do. Those will be attached to our research roundup email that our registered users at macrovoices.com will receive at the same time as this podcast. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me on the program. Nathan Egger will be back with me as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
All right, Eric, I feel you and Jeff Christian just pretty much zipped us around the globe there in record time. Tons of illumination on a wide variety of subjects. And you know, as I said, I've heard a lot about him in the precious metals world, but I wasn't aware he and his firm were active in so many other areas.
Yeah, Jeff's a really good guy. I've known him for several years, and I think he's a little bit of a masochist. He tries to debunk the gold bug conspiracy theories. He's trying to help people because he has a passion for the truth. In many cases, the people he's trying to help are people who don't want to be helped. And he's kind of been labeled as, you know, the public enemy number one of the gold bugs. But he's a super talented guy, and we actually talked off the air, and I said, give me a list of topics. I don't want to keep it precious metals centric that you're comfortable covering. And Jeff is a formally trained journalist, and he said, what are you talking about? Your job is to ask me hard questions, including ones I don't know the answer to. That's what journalism's all about. And I just love his style. And Jeff and I know each other well enough that he could say that. I said, okay, fine. And I very intentionally just said, okay, let's take it around the globe. He didn't know what was coming. And I'm just hitting him with China, Japan, Russia. He didn't know who Sergei Glazyev was, but frankly, neither has pretty much any other guest I've asked that question of. But he's a super guy, and I always enjoy his commentary, and I think he has a very level-headed perspective. He's one of the very few people I know who is in the precious metals business who doesn't really have a permanent bullish bias. You know, it's not buy precious metals because I'm in the business of selling them to you. It's I'm in the business of consulting, and right now, he said, I think we could be in for a soft patch. We had the gold market. He does seem to think that the bottom is in, but he thinks it's gotten ahead of itself and maybe is in for a soft patch. You don't hear that from the coin dealers. So I really appreciate Jeff's perspective, and you know, frankly, every time my inbox pops up with a CPM Group research paper, I'm always eager to see it. Because
Eric, while you're speaking of research papers, sorry, I need to interrupt you here, because we've been doing this research roundup, which we email to all of our registered guests so that they can get the supporting documents that we mention on the show. And we've had a lot of emails from listeners in the past week who have been asking to be signed up to our research roundup so they can receive those papers, charts, presentations, and all this. We can't sign you up for you. What you'll need to do is go to www.macrovoices.com and click on the button that says log in or register. There you will be able to create an account with us. And it's not going to cost you anything. You will not receive any spam. We will never sell your email address to anybody. But you will receive the research roundup that we will be continuing to refer to in the future, and a notification as well when new shows are published. You'll also gain access to our listener discussion forums, and there you can discuss subjects covered on the show and also recommend to us future show guests and topics. Just needed to get that out of the way. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, so we'll now return to our non-commercial program, which has no commercial breaks or interruptions. Anyway, I love the CPM Group stuff. It's level-headed. It's not skewed in terms of a bullish view in what they happen to be selling, and I love those guys.
Eric, while you were talking with Jeff, I got a little confused about a number of things. First of all, what were you getting at when you were asking Jeff about the commitments of traders' reports for gold? And you mentioned something about arbitrage flows. Is there any way that you can shine further light on those subjects and explain to me why exactly were you asking him that?
Yeah, I was curious whether he would share a view that I have been persuaded by. I don't want to take credit for it. It was actually Bron Suchecki, who used to be with Perth Mint and has moved on to another position now, who I interviewed years ago, who really woke me up to this. And he, first of all, we should explain his background, what commitment of traders reports are. Large traders, anybody in the futures market who trades more than a certain number of contracts, is required by law to report their positions to the government. And the government then publishes what's known as the Commitment of Traders Reports. And it shows what is the net long and net short exposure of different categories of traders. So the commercial traders are like the big banks and large commercial enterprises. The speculators are hedge funds and individual traders and people that are speculating in these markets. And the idea is that if you know that the speculators tend to be the ones that change their mind and give up on positions and so forth, when everybody's on one side of the boat, you want to be on the other side of the boat. And that's what the Commitment of Traders reports are used for by futures traders. I use it, and I put a lot of faith in it, in something like the crude oil market, because those tell you where all the large traders are positioned. The NYMEX is basically the whole West Texas Intermediate crude oil futures contract. Now, of course, there are physical markets which are not traded as futures, but most of them are all indexed to that WTI futures contract price. So the futures contract is discovering the price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil. That's where the price gets set. It's the definitive source, and that's it. A lot of the people in the gold and silver community point to these Commitment of Traders reports, and they say, Look at what's going on with how big the commercial short interest is. There's a conspiracy here. Something's going on. Well, first of all, there's no conspiracy. It makes perfect sense that large commercials who have vaults that are full of gold and silver, if they want to not take market risk, they hold the long position in the metal and then a short position in the futures contract in order to hedge their risk to zero so that their value of their position doesn't go up and down with the market, but they have the gold on hand in order to be able to meet the needs of their customers and so forth. So it really does make sense in that regard. But what Bron pointed out to me is, wait a minute. Most of the action in gold is all in the London Bullion Metal Exchange. It's not in the COMEX futures contract. Most of the volume of gold is all traded in London. And what happens anytime you have multiple markets is a process called arbitrage. In other words, if the price of gold gets to be 50 cents per ounce higher in London than it is in New York, what the banks are going to do is make a profit from that. They're going to sell London gold and buy New York gold. And in theory, they would have to move that gold from New York to London in order to settle that. But they don't do it that way. They just keep exploiting these little inefficiencies, and eventually it all washes out and they don't have to move any physical gold around. They're just leveling the price back and forth. So what Bron pointed out to me is, when you look at the positions of the commercials changing, you know, they just added 5,000 contracts since the last weekly report, and suddenly the commercials are more short than they were or less short than they were. Does it really mean that anybody bought or sold anything? Or does it just mean that those are banks that are noticing imbalances between London and New York prices, and their positions are changing, quite understandably, because as they arbitrage those price differences, that means that their COMEX exposure, that's the number that's visible in the Commitment of Traders reports, is going to go up and down reflective of what's going on in London. And the true story of how the biggest traders are really positioned would be hidden in over-the-counter derivatives contracts, forwards, traded on the London Metals Exchange, which we don't have visibility to. So Bron's argument is COT is irrelevant to precious metals because the COMEX is not the primary market for them, and therefore the positioning of who's on the COMEX is more of an indication of arbitrage flows between London and New York as opposed to anybody's actual positioning.
This makes sense to me, Eric, and I appreciate you clarifying that, but that is not nearly as fun as a juicy Illuminati conspiracy theory to suppress the price of gold. So we received a huge increase in the amount of ratings and reviews on iTunes in the last week. So I just want to thank listeners who took the time to do either of those. And I just want to remind you guys that while we don't want your money, you can still support us hugely and support the program in a big way by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on iTunes. If you don't know how to do this, please email me at nathan@macrovoices.com and I'll help you get it worked out. You can follow us on Twitter at Macro Voices, and while you're there, if you're interested in getting updates throughout the week from Eric, follow his personal handle. That's at E-R-I-K-S Townsend. If you don't do the social media thing, but you'd like to continue the discussion of topics covered on the show, please join us in our forums at macrovoices.com/forums. We'll be back next week with Julian Brigden. He's the co-founder and president of Macro Intelligence 2 Partners, and he's another brilliant macro mind. So we sincerely hope you'll be kind enough to join us again. For Eric Townsend, this is Nathan Egger wishing you all a great weekend. We'll see you next time.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.